quite exciting for me. I think that today has been such a joy because from John Peacock's to Sarah's to Bodha Kinchino and Judd's presentations really laid the foundation for what I'll be talking about in so many different ways. So you'll see those interconnections around Vedana as I speak about it. And one of the intentions that I had with writing this paper, because I've been out of the academic world for about 3 years, so I haven't been like writing and doing research, but it's to really apply the research, something Carrie had mentioned in the beginning. How can a lot of this work be applied in the real world, all this knowledge, in order to really alleviate suffering for the people that are, you know, living with the realities that are consequences of bias? So with that said, what I'll do is, because I wrote a draft of the paper, so I'll read it, but I have some interactive visuals to accompany them as I read them. So, and then I hope we'll have a fruitful discussion afterwards. So I began the paper, I call this topic Vedana of Racial Bias, Latent Likes and Dislikes Fueling Barriers to Human Connection. And starting this out with a quote, all things appear and disappear because of the concurrence of causes and conditions. Nothing ever exists entirely alone. Everything is in relation to everything else. So that's a quote by the Buddha, which I find is really kind of the meat, the crux of what bias itself is. So the Buddha is remembered as one of the greatest psychologists in human history. His teachings have left humanity with a blueprint that any person, regardless of age, background, gender, class, or color, can use to make sense of the human mind, particularly through wise mindfulness, one of the eight spokes of the Noble Eightfold Path. So for me, having studied and worked on this topic in very, very diverse communities across the globe, from the US to Mexico and Myanmar and Korea, this work is really about, you know, dedicating my life to understanding this idea of bias and hacking it, understanding solutions to it. How do we transform it by utilizing the Dharma? So as a scholar and practitioner, I'm particularly intrigued by the existing parallels between the four foundations of mindfulness and the nature of bias, particularly racial bias as it exists in the US and other historically colonized society. So in this paper, I will shed light on the range of feeling tones or Vedana that are associated with the phenomenon of racial bias. And my hope is really fourfold, which is really kind of getting a deeper understanding into the current racial realities as context to understand racial bias, then the relationship between racial bias, particularly unconscious racial bias, with Vedana, some of the causes and conditions that are responsible for the arising of, you know, latent likes and dislikes of Vedana associated with cross-racial human contact and relations, and three ways investigation of latent likes and dislikes, or Vedana of bias, and the chain of emotions, mental states, and or thoughts they initiate may help with understanding and transforming the arising of bias to alleviate needless human suffering across society. So with that said, I'd love to start with setting the context, which is understanding racial bias. So for us, the first spoke of the Noble Eightfold Path begins with wise understanding, or seeing things for what they are. To understand the deeper roots of racial bias within the conscious and unconscious mind, it is first imperative to acknowledge the racial realities in American society. So currently, roughly 40% of Americans are classified as non-white, that is, Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, and more recently, Arab Americans. The figures that you'll see on these charts present a very kind of a snapshot of racial realities in the U.S. with respect to a few social and economic indicators. So 63 years after the case, Brown v. Board of Education, which was a seminal case that overturned Jim Crow segregation in the United States, two-thirds of Americans would have to physically move neighborhoods for us to be fully integrated. And beyond that, as figure one shows on the top, that the state of social segregation in the U.S. with respect to social segregation, a majority of Black, White, and Latino Americans socialize exclusively within their racial groups. So that's 83% of Black Americans, 91% of White Americans, and 64% of Latinos. With respect to education, as figure two shows, one in two Black and Latino children attend high poverty and low resource schools compared to one in 20 white children. Although there are more poor white children in the US than poor Black and Latino children, the majority of poor white children attend schools where most children are middle class, while the majority of non-white children attend schools where most children are poor, and the neighborhoods have higher rates of violence, crime, and poverty. When it comes to poverty, as figure three shows, the overall American poverty rate oscillates between around 10%. With respect to background, however, one in four African Americans, one in five Latinos, and one in three Native Americans live in poverty, compared to one in 11 white Americans. Not only that, the median net worth of a white family is over $160,000 compared to $16,000 for a Black family and $18,000 for a Latino family. When it comes to commission of crimes, studies have repeatedly shown that controlling for factors such as poverty and social disadvantage, there's no difference in the rates of crimes committed across racial groups. Yet as figure four shows, while only 13% of Americans are Black, 38% of American adults in state and federal prisons and local jails, and 41% of prisoners on death row are Black. So beyond the above, there are countless other examples of racial disparities with respect to health outcomes, to the quality of healthcare received by non-white patients, to disparities in employment, income, college, graduate school matriculation, blah, 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 you get the point. And economists estimate that racial bias costs the American economy over $1 trillion a year. So it's not just a human cost, it's also a monetary cost. So having like learned about these figures, I'd love for you to just notice the wandering mind and its possible attempts to explain these outcomes, right? What theories, scenarios, and stories conjure up? And before proceeding forward and without needing to explain these realities, notice the Vedana associated with looking at and acknowledging these realities, you know, unpleasant, pleasant, neutral. What underlying emotions are connected to this feeling tone? Shame, unease, guilt, anger, indifference. A lot of these things we've talked about today. And what thoughts or storylines, explanations are connected to them? Individual responsibility, culture, institutional racism, something else. Whatever these explanations may be, just holding them for the remainder of the time, our time together, and observing these explanations with respect to this topic. So with that said, I'm going to move to a little bit forward to really talking about the relationship between Vedana and racial bias. So there was an exercise that was handed out to you at the beginning. It's just a little paper. It's called the matching game. So I'd love for you to pull it out. And you'll probably need a pen for this exercise. So basically, turn to page one, and you'll see on page one, there's a center column which has either an image or a word. And to the left and the right are two circles. And on top, on the top row, it says flowers or pleasant words, or insects or unpleasant words. So basically, whatever you see in the center column, you just have to match in the correct category. So for example, that first row, you see an image. Is that an insect or a flower? It's an insect. So you would check the box under insect, right? And then on the second row, the word is gentle. Is that a pleasant word or an unpleasant word? Pleasant, usually, so pleasant. So we're going to all do this together, except we're going to do it really quickly. So you have 30 seconds to do page one. Does anyone have any questions before we start, though? Yes. Oh, we need some pens. Ooh. I have one.
start. We're all going to start together.
This is our competitive, yeah, we're getting.
So we have one more. I didn't plan for pens. My apologies. Okay. One more?
Anybody else?
All right. So you all get to your seats. Page one. Ready, set. Ready, set, go. And stop. Flip the page, that was 30 seconds. So it's the same exercise that you're doing, except the categories on top have changed. You'll see the words and the images. Page two, right? Does anyone have any questions about doing this one? Same exercise.
What has changed?
On the top, so you'll see, so pleasant word or flowers. On the other side, it was pleasant words or reasons, I believe. Right? Ready, set, go. And stop. Okay. So if you want to take a few seconds just to see if how many you were able to, you weren't able to finish on either side, or if you made any errors, you can. So how was that exercise? Just maybe two or three people for you. Yes.
I got a few more done the second time.
Okay. Right. So there was a strategy that you had employed to like finish the test as quickly as possible. So has anyone taken this thing before?
Well, I've taken the one about rings.
Yeah.
And it was palpable.
Right.
I could feel it in myself as I filled out the part when it was positive words and pictures of black people and negative words and pictures of, and I was like, I'm slowing down.
Yeah. So this is known as the implicit association test, right? So basically, this is everything that we've talked about today, from what Vedana itself is, and what's happening is, and I'll read a little bit. So this test usually is administered online. So unlike these particular test conditions that we all undertook, and there were so many things happening. What happens is that you go on a computer and there are images that are flashing and words that are flashing, and then it tells you that hit the key E or I for pleasant words, or X phase or unpleasant words, and Y phase. And you have to do this as rapidly as possible. And on the back end, there's a program called Inquisit, which is able to measure the response latencies, the delays in response at the millisecond level, to see if you can make any errors or how, if there's a delay when certain concepts are in the same category. And what a lot of social psychologists have really found over the last two decades and a half, that this is really able to measure one's unconscious associations, what is known as implicit bias or unconscious bias. And there's a whole host of study that's begun since this test was really created in 1998 out of Harvard. And over 2,000 studies have shown that the results of this test really impact or are able to explain discriminatory behavior even without conscious intent. So that's really important, right? Because they'd have millions of data sets and data points to show that it's not just something that people are consciously doing, it's happening because there are these subtle, latent, whatever associations that may be in the consciousness only due to people's phenotype. So I'll read a little bit around this. For the last, over the last 15 years, the IIT has been able to measure the latent associations, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, that people have with respect to appearance of human beings. Hundreds of scholarly studies have been written about the instruments, and leading scientists have concluded that the IIT is able to measure implicit associations, which can also be understood as implicit or unconscious bias, and more importantly, predict human behavior, specifically with respect to unconscious behavioral patterns that result in discrimination in various professional and personal settings. With the sample of, with the sample points given the ease of the instrument's use, scientists predict that over 75% of Americans have an automatic preference for whites, including a majority of non-whites, though not to the same extent. So in fact, Project Implicit, which manages the national and international data on IIT results, released the map showing the IIT responses from white Americans.
Well, it's in the paper.
And the map shows the states with the highest levels of implicit bias, which is in red, and lowest levels of implicit bias, which is in blue, and there's gray, which is in the middle. And overall, the map reflects scores of 1.51 million white Americans. And what's important to note about the figure is that it doesn't represent a random sample of Americans. Instead, the individual respondents are people who voluntarily chose to take the test. So the inventor of the test said that this actually may mean that these individuals are less biased than average because they wanted to know how biased they are. They actually went onto this platform to take the test. But regardless of the gravity of the map's accuracy, the map indicates that at the very subtle level, there's an unpleasant vedana that is associated with non-white and particularly black faces among a large number of white Americans. Scholars have indicated that much of these latent dislikes are unconscious and is often also present among non-whites, including blacks. The vedana of bias in these circumstances is the affective tone that stirs the mind to dictate words, actions, behaviors, and decisions that are erroneous from a professional decision-making perspective. For example, hiring a less competent person for the job or prescribing inaccurate dosage of pain medication that when aggregated across society becomes disparities that I've mentioned earlier. So I'll give three examples. Maybe I'll just give two to illustrate the point. Two patients, one white and one black, arrive at an emergency room complaining of knee pain. Both patients ask for pain medicine while they wait to see a specialist. The black patient is much more likely to be refused the medication or given a lower dose of medication than the white patient. As studies have shown, many health professionals have an unconscious bias that may alter their perception of the pain of darker-skinned patients. Studies have further shown that many white physicians carry false beliefs about biological difference of black people, including believing that blacks age more slowly than whites, blacks have thicker skin than whites, and they have less sensitive nerve endings. So how may unpleasant vedana connected to appearance of a patient affect the decisions of a health professional in this setting? Similarly, 60 partners at a law firm are asked to review a memo of a junior associate. While all the memos are identical in content, half are authored by an associate with a name associated with a black American, and the other half by an associate with a name associated with a white person. So it's been shown that the manager's evaluation of the memo hinged on the perceived race of the associate. When the associate was perceived to be black, the evaluators found more of the embedded errors and rated the memo as lower quality compared to when the author was perceived to be white. This was true for evaluators of both genders as well as those who were non-white. So how may unpleasant Vedana connected to the perceived appearance and background of the associate impact this person's performance evaluation? And what implications may present with respect to the associate's compensation, retention, ability to rise in the firm, and future career path? Again, all starting with this first initial contact point of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. So for me, what's really interesting around this is how this aggregates across society and the importance of this. So the Vedana associated with physical appearance among whites further impacts social outcomes for all communities, white and non-white, because members of this group hold the majority of decision-making positions and roles of influence in our society and disproportionate to their population. So there's a figure in the paper that shows this. So about 60% of Americans are whites, but when it comes to US senators, 90%. You know, US governors, 94%. Fortune 500 CEOs, 97%. You know, professors, 84%. Major publishers, 85%. So you get the point. But the idea is, if these unconscious biases are deeply seated, now because the decision makers may not acknowledge them or know that they have them, because consciously they may not have any biases, but they're still present because of the Vedana associated with literally phenotype, it may perpetuate these inequities. So this really goes to the causes and conditions. Where does this come from? What is the Vedana of racial bias? You know, I'm sure a lot of you have really heard of the Human Genome Project. It came out about 17 years ago in 2000 that proved that there's actually no genetic basis for race. Race is, you know, a lot of people say it's a social construct, right? It's a really highfalutin term. But basically what they're saying is that what the human genome found, having looked at the human DNA, is that, well, I'll read specifically the... that basically human beings are 99.9% genetically identical. And not only that, the vast majority of human, you know, genetic diversity exists within racial categories, not across. So, and what they've actually found is, for example, a Kenyan and a Chinese person may be more genetically similar than two Kenyans and two Chinese people, you know. And also the vast majority of human diversity when it comes to our genetic material is in sub-Saharan Africa, which is also really fascinating. So someone from Botswana may be very different from someone from Nigeria versus someone from Ethiopia. And why is that? Well, there's theories around it, but no one really knows exactly why, but that's just how humans have evolved. So where does this Vedana of bias come from? So this is Stephen Jay Gould, who was a really famous evolutionary biologist. The shift from a geographic to a hierarchical order of human diversity marks a fateful transition in the history of Western science for what, short of railroads and nuclear bombs, had more practical impact, in the case almost entirely negative, upon our collective lives and nationalities. Ironically, J.F. Blumenbach, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, is the focus of this shift, for his five-race scheme became canonical, and he changed the geometry of human order to linear ranking by putative worth. So race, when we say it's a social construct, it's a story. And the story of race was invented by a bunch of guys that are on this screen, guys like Linnaeus and Blumenbach in particular, but also, you know, some of the other scholars that have been mentioned here, Kant, Emerson, they were big believers in this idea. And it was a product of people that loved to collect skulls and body parts of people from across the world. And central to this story was the invention of the race Caucasian, which was based on a skull. So Johann von Blumenbach This is how the story started. After visiting the Caucasus Mountains in the region of Georgia, Blumenbach declared its inhabitants to be the most beautiful in the world, created in God's image, and deemed the region to be the origin of human bloodline. This is in the 1700s. He's writing this book in 1795, but that's when it was published. He decided that all light-skinned people, including all Europeans, originated in this region, creating a new category called Caucasian. He proposed four other races that were each considered physically and morally degenerate forms of God's creation. He classified them as Ethiopians, Mongolians, Malayans, and Americans. And here's how he described them. All mankind seems to me, as it may be best, be divided into five following varieties: Caucasian, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American, and Malay. I have allotted the first place to the Caucasian, which make me esteem it to be the best one. This diverges in both directions in two most remote and very different from each other. On the one side, Ethiopian, on the other, Mongolian. The remaining two occupy the intermediate position between the best one and these two extremes. That is American between Caucasian and Mongolian, and Malay between Caucasian and Ethiopian. It's all made up. The vast diversity of humanity, so many different cultures, so many different ethnicities, literally put down into these five categories based on someone's subjective evaluation of them. And once the story was created, each one of these categories was prescribed a host of aesthetic, intellectual, moral, and behavioral attributes, which is in this paper, and I can read a few of them to you. Caucasian and the attributes Linnaeus and Blumenbach prescribed to them: vigorous, muscular, flowing blonde hair, blue eyes, very smart, inventive, ruled by law, creative, pinnacle of human perfection. Malay or American: ill-tempered, impassive, thick black hair, wide nostrils, harsh face, beardless, stubborn. Ethiopian: sluggish, lazy, black kinky hair, flat nose, thick lips, crafty, slow, careless, covered by grease, ruled by caprice. So just notice the vedana associated with the words, the images that were associated with, again, these attributes, literally planted upon entire categories of people, right, based purely on appearance, both on the positive realm for creation of this new category of Caucasian, and then the other four categories. This racialized hierarchy of humanity elevated the fictional category of Caucasians to the highest level of creation, ranking all other human beings in terms of their innate pathology. And simultaneously in this period, European elites amassed booty from global expeditions, creating curiosity cabinets in which their hierarchical worldview was articulated through a strategic arrangement of natural artifacts. These cabinets evolved into world fairs, public museum, orientalist images, books, stories, motion pictures, minstrel shows, and circuses of the 19th and 20th centuries for the consumption of the broader public, to again spread this story and its associated ideas about different types of people. Not only that, the story was adopted by governments, you know, everywhere from the US. So the 1790 Naturalization Act required one be a free white person in order to become a citizen. And that didn't change until 1965. So again, this story was a requirement for one to have social, political, economic rights in this country. To, you know, colonies in Latin America, across Africa, India, Australia, Dutch Indonesia, often reserving citizenship and all sorts of rights that are oftentimes exclusively reserved for whomever was qualified to be white. So these policies placed onerous limitations on the lives and livelihoods of people who were classified as non-white, including their ability to be educated, travel, own property, engage in commerce, the political process, and be protected by the law. And today, while most legalized forms of discrimination based on the story are no longer state policy, the stereotypes and the attributes associated with members of non-white groups remain prevalent. And that's the challenge. That's what the Vedana is about. These stereotypes and false beliefs continue to be perpetuated by advertisers, marketers, filmmakers, media makers, to subtly strengthen the Vedana attached to the phenotype of being non-white. So, for example, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the news and entertainment media instruct and teach their viewers about the character attributes of non-whites. So with respect to media's mind training through stories and character representations, two issues arise. First is the issue of non-representation or invisibility. And a comprehensive study on diversity in entertainment showed that 7% of American films and 19% of American TV programming had a cast that reflected American diversity. And this is really true for me. When I was growing up, one of the most popular movies was Indiana Jones, Temple of the Doom. And I grew up in an Indian family, you know, fairly devout Hindus, but there were people represented who were eating monkey brains. My entire family was vegetarian. They're revered animals. But for millions of people across the world who are watching this movie, you know, Indians became associated with savage. And I know that from personal experience because that's what I was referred to when I was in middle school, you know, after we immigrated here. So this is the power of these images and the Vedana associated with that, and then transplanted on the experience of human beings that are living it. And, you know, given the hyper-segregation in the country, this mass media curriculum has become particularly powerful with respect to the educational impact it has on people who have little or no direct contact with members outside their groups. So it's strengthening the pleasant and unpleasant Vedana associated with group membership. The IIT studies have also shown that this also impacts the self-conception and self-esteem of non-whites at the unconscious level, which may be an explanation for why a majority of non-whites also display an unconscious preference for whites on the IIT. So this is kind of similar to the image that you'd shared, Judd, in your presentation on, you know, the causes and conditions, the influences from news and entertainment and media that's creating these pleasant and pleasant or neither images, which then become these latent likes and dislikes in our society. So these are the categories. Again, based purely on geography, they're super artificial, but again, very much a part of our collective consciousness now, and then perpetuated by images, right, that we see around us in the media, in books we read, in entertainment, in news. Again, to the policies, this is being regulated socially in a country, and now it's not by law, but it's de facto because of hypersegregation. Where people are choosing to live because, again, of the Vedana associated with what it means to live in a neighborhood that's predominantly X or Y, what it means to be someone from an X community or a Y community, whether it's Black or Latino, Mexican, Asian. An example that I like to give is, these are images from Hurricane Katrina of people trying to get to safe grounds, but the image on the top is of a Black person, and it's being reported as a young man walks through chest-deep flood water after looting a grocery store, whereas the images on the bottom is of what seems to be a white couple, two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda. And these are aerial images, right? But then again, what is the association with these people's humanity? Has the photographer and the journalist gone to interview these people? Has he followed them around, or she followed them around to know what they did and what their story is? But there's this association with looter, with a Black person, and a finder, with a white person. There could be a more neutral word, carry, take. But, you know, and this is where a lot of these unconscious, really, really unconscious beliefs can have a massive trickle effect across society. Oh, here's the map that I was referring to. So the figure on the top is actually the study about white physicians and the beliefs they endorse about biological difference between Blacks and whites. For example, whites have larger brains than Blacks. Blacks have more sensitive sense of smell than whites. Blacks are better at detecting movement than whites. Again, a lot of these things are based on, again, these attributes that these pseudoscientists had prescribed to different categories, but they're still kind of in the mix, setting off that point. So what do we do about it? So this is, I'll finish off and I'd love some discussion. So 5 decades of robust research has provided us with definitive data on the multitude of benefits of mindfulness practices, including mitigating unconscious racial bias. The IIT now presents an opportunity for researchers and social impact leaders to measure Vedana, or the latent likes and dislikes that the human unconscious mind has stored within it with respect to the racial classification of other humans. More broadly, the research makes clear that the Vedana attached to different racial groups is conditioned, as illustrated by the Hebb's rule, neurons that fire together, wire together. It's the repeated reinforcement of specific words, specific images, that then kind of set in into our and become deeply ingrained in our own minds. The Vedana of racial bias is a product of repeated reinforcement of latent likes and dislikes people are exposed to through the barrage of stereotypical, exaggerated, non-representative, and often false images and stories they receive through the 5 senses about human attributes based on the story of race. And when coupled with institutional decision-making, these perceptions held within the human consciousness make social, economic, and political inequities a self-fulfilling prophecy. So what can we do about it? Because that's what I really love to talk about, future directions, particularly with this research, with some neuroscientists in the room. I think there's a huge opportunity to actually transform this bias. And there's already early research that has shown that mindfulness practice, metta practice, reduces implicit bias, reduces both from the race angle, gender angle, age angle. And this is because the IIT can measure the gravity and the extent of these subconscious associations. And because we can measure it, we can transform it. And this is where I love that analogy of a spectrum, right? From pleasant to unpleasant. That's already there that we can actually now put on that scale. And the idea isn't to bring people to neutral, which would be nice, but actually to bring awareness to the unpleasantness, bring awareness to the pleasantness. What about that is pleasant? What about this is unpleasant? Where does it come from? And really creating that investigation so it doesn't impact the way we interact in the world, but also meets our deeper values around ethics and virtues on which the Dharma stands. So institutionally, through a greater mindfulness of representations and depictions of the humanity of different human beings, decision makers have the opportunity to transform the causes and conditions that mold, enable, and sustain the Vedana, right? What marketers like to call tastes of the public. The opportunity this presents is to really undo the myth of different human races once and for all, and imagine the possibility of human multiplicity arising out of different cultural and geographic environments, each one symbolizing the creative and innovative nature of human imagination. This may strengthen the virtue of wisdom in our social and cultural life and enable human connection. Second, I feel like there's a way for us to really take this on interpersonally. Through a deeper investigation into the Vedana when it comes to interacting and relating with people from groups other than our own. And this may actually result in 2 very desirable outcomes. First, it will strengthen social connection, belonging, and intimacy between people, and thereby reduce conflict, anxiety, and worry that presents itself in a cross-racial and cross-cultural interaction. Second, it will enable healing internally, particularly around unfounded fears that the mind and body has been conditioned to carry because of the story of race and the barrage of media images and depictions that have strengthened that story in the human consciousness. So this really goes back to your comment around what you shared about the Jewish American woman and her fear that, you know, she literally was able to get out of her body, right, in that circle about a German doctor and a Palestinian woman. But it wasn't something that she was born with, but it was something that she had accumulated and, of course, was causing her an inordinate amount of suffering. And this process of really cleansing, so it's almost like neuro-decolonization, right? this process of cleansing would require a much deeper awareness of and insight into the sensory and mental experience of Vedana when contact is made with the human senses. At the initial moment of contact, the mind-body unit responds based on its conditioning. The awareness of the initial moment of contact and the associated Vedana can transform not only the feeling tone of racial bias, but also become the social bomb humans crave and need to build connection with other members of our species. And my hope is this can only result through making Vedana and the Vedana of bias itself seen, felt, and known in a cross-cultural and cross-racial context. So what's the nature of the latent dislike or like? What are the stories attached to it? What past experiences arise? Are they based on a personal experience or experience of another person? What, you know, and is it, or is it stored through another vector like media, education, a movie? And that this chain of dependent origination can become better known through heightened awareness and intimacy with the Vedana of bias. And last, I think that there is an opportunity to really use, you know, more research into Vedana to really transform our internal life. There's been so much research in psychology to demonstrate the numerous unconscious ways humans limit their own potential based on unfounded false beliefs. In the Buddhist realm, these beliefs come under the purview of the poison of ignorance or delusion. Just as there's Vedana attached to racial bias that is being enacted externally, there's also Vedana attached to bias being enacted internally when it serves as a roadblock in individual performance or their ability to enjoy life. So research into the phenomenon of stereotype threat and overcompensation are helpful in understanding how Vedana associated with a model of a perfectionist self may create and further, you know, loops of suffering in people's internal life. So stereotype threat is this phenomenon that's been pretty well studied, particularly by this psychologist named Claude Steele, where what they've done is they've given, let's say, students from different backgrounds a standardized test, but when they're asked to indicate their race before the test, Black students perform worse. And what's going on there, the assumption, the theory is that it basically rises, it creates anxiety at the unconscious level. So the mind is busy controlling for the stereotypes associated with being of that particular race than being focused at the task at hand. Similarly, they've done various studies, and this one anecdote that's really poignant is there's a grad student walking down Hyde Park in Chicago, which is in a really relatively good neighborhood, but he could feel that people around him are uncomfortable. And he's wearing casual clothing, he happens to be Black, but he's, you know, he's like, I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago, one of the best schools in my program, but he can see that. So he starts whistling a tune from, you know, Vivaldi. And suddenly people are smiling, they're easeful, because he's basically managing the stereotype threat of what it means to be who he is, right? Again, all of the associations that are coupled with being someone in his body. So I feel that strengthening this awareness of Vedana of bias with the experience of self may also interrupt the dukkha of becoming and the epidemic of self-loathing that appears to be rising in Western and now non-Western societies too. And this is particularly important in a fast-moving world where the senses are regularly interacting with an onslaught of stimulation from the outer world. So in conclusion, bias is a complex phenomenon. It is a topic that stirs for each one of us a response that is uncomfortable and disheartening, consciously or unconsciously. So this paper, I really attempted to provide an interdisciplinary summary of the multidimensionality of racial bias, particularly from the lens of Vedana, the second foundation of mindfulness. And the hope really is that we can use insights into this concept of Vedana, understanding particularly the Vedana of bias and racial bias and its causes, how mindfulness can hack and transform it institutionally, interpersonally, and then internally. Though, like my paper focused on racial bias, its themes can be applied to understand the role of bias and role of Vedana in that bias for other forms of human identity, such as gender, sexual orientation, religion, class, age, ability, size, and many, many others. So I like to end most of my trainings and workshops that I give with this one particular quote, which is a quote from Gandhi, which says, "Your beliefs become your thoughts become your words become your actions become your habits become your values, and your values become your destiny." And that's very similar to something the Buddha had said too, because it really starts at that belief level. And here we start with the belief in the story of race, which again is a very false hierarchy that was constructed just a few hundred years ago. But how do we really dismantle that to build more human connection through greater awareness of what's behind it? So with that, let's have a discussion. It's pretty late.